and then we can talk about, I want to talk about therapy and healthcare. I know you said you've done therapy. I don't know if you want to talk that up, about that at all. I won't bring it up if you don't want me to.
I might touch on it a little bit.
Yeah.
We'll see. We'll see how the conversation goes.
Right. And because I have, like I said in the email, I have issues with the idea of therapy. I've never done it. So,
okay.
I was going to bring that up just to talk about that too. I don't know if that we should close with that because it could end up being kind of hypercritical because we'll talk about the healthcare industry, or should we close with self care? What do you think?
Let's close with self-care.
Yeah, I think that's it.
My first name is a random set of numbers and letters and other alphanumerics that changes hourly forever. My last name, a thousand vowels fitting down a sinkhole to a susurrus. It couldn't just be John Doe or Bingo. My address, a made-up language written out in living glyphs, lifted from demonic literature and religious texts. Telephone uncovered by purveyors of the Ouija, then checked against the CBGB women's room graffiti. My social is Sudoku, my age is obscure. My in case of emergency is in the daisies chasing birds.
Do we have any quick takes today?
Not really, because I've been out of town for a work conference, and then like I came back, and then work was busy as hell, and then I had the funeral, so it's been hectic. So like, other than the madness that happened today, I've been sort of out of the news loop.
I mean, you haven't missed too much. We know that Trump is Putin's puppet, but we already knew that.
We knew that, yeah. None of this is new.
Yeah, there are quite a few Republicans that are giving this, like, oh shit, kind of expression. A couple more than the word tipped away. Some people resigned here and there, but at the end of the day, like, I don't think this moves the needle, really.
No. Nothing's new, really. It's just, the only thing that's new is, like, the boldness of of his stupidity.
Yeah.
Like, that's the only thing that's really new. It's like, oh, he's this stupid. That's kind of clicking with, you know, certain Republicans.
Stupider like a fox news.
Yeah.
That should be his thing. Stupider like a fox news.
Oh, Tucker Carlson, man. That guy. That guy's undefeated, man.
Wow. That dude. He's cornered the geek O'Reilly look.
Yeah. He'll defend anything. Yeah. Like anything Trump does.
Oh, you didn't see what he said today. He said, Russia's not a big problem in Mexico. They keep packing our electorate.
Ooh.
I know.
Ah.
I know.
Oh.
Yeah.
Just right with the racism. Just, oh, yeah. Here you go.
Yeah. No. He's not even. He's rolling up his sleeve, man. He's tying that leather belt around his arm. He's giving you the straight cheese, man. There's no holding back.
He's going to be the White House press secretary. It's going to happen.
You know what? I kind of want that.
Oh.
I kind of want that. I don't know why. Maybe this is masochism at this point. But,
yeah.
I wanted to bring up, while we're talking about, you know, our shitty presidency. Still talking about it. We didn't bring up Ronald Reagan last week.
We didn't.
That's in our defense, there's a lot of presidents to pick from that suck. But, yeah.
Well, Reagan, I mean, we were trying to use it to shed light on people who maybe got shat on less than they should, or less got, you know, criticized less than they should, like FDR. Like, that was what I was going for. I'm assuming anybody who's listening to this knows Ronald Reagan is a piece of shit.
Well said. Let's just put him on the top of the priority for our own fuck-up. After all, Make America Great Again was his slogan, right? So,
yeah. I mean, we didn't talk about Nixon either, you know?
Well, Nixon, he got his, like we talked about.
Yeah, that's true.
All right. Okay, so anything else we want to touch on before we get into our big topic for the day?
No, I think that's, yeah, I just can't, I've been out of it. It's good to be back to thinking about what's going on.
Well, we're not going to be thinking about what's going on because we're talking about ourselves. Today's episode, for those of you who are still listening to us, is going to be about mental health. So, because of, you know, people like Anthony Bourdain on the darker side, but also just because of the sort of openness of social media, mental health and mental health conversations have been increasingly happening, at least on Twitter, which is my only pulse to what's happening in the country, I'll admit. So we decided that we should have a mental health episode because a lot of the rhetoric surrounding mental health, especially on social media and in other places, is just have the conversation, talk about it. Don't be scared to admit that you have anxiety or stress or something more, you know, severe or in need of management. That's the only way to reduce some of the stigma. So that's what we're doing. We're going to try to do that. Joe, I guess, you know, as usual, we'll start with you. You're in mid-30s now. You're a middle-aged man. Mm-hmm. How's the conversation about mental health changed in your life? What was it like coming up? Do you struggle with the stigmas in any way? Like, where's your head at about this stuff?
I struggle talking about anxiety that I personally go through. I think we have a more open conversation now with like the Twitter society that we live in where everybody has a voice and sort of people who go through mental anguish are more open about it now. Like we know like Kevin Durant goes through depression. Like, can you think of any athlete as we were growing up that you would know that they were going through something like that and it wouldn't be shunned, you know? I think that's the conversation's different because now we're willing to, we sort of know that everybody else is really going through the same thing we're going through, which I think we didn't really have pre-social media. I'm anxious from time to time. Sometimes I purposely don't do things because they make me uncomfortable. And it's something I kind of don't like to talk about openly because I'm a super prideful person. Anyone who knows me knows, like, I eat my Kool-Aid. I drink my Kool-Aid. Like, I fucking, you know, I'm one to sing my praises.
Well, you went and bought that Kool-Aid. You mixed that Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
You put that Kool-Aid in the fridge overnight. You're all about it.
But that's only because, like, I'm so confident in the things I'm confident in. Like, you don't hear me, you know, like, I'm one to not do something very quickly if I think I will fail at it. And that goes back to an anxiety that I have that probably wouldn't be talking about if we weren't in a society now where it's okay to explore these things openly.
Yeah. What you said about, if I could go back a couple sentences.
Yeah.
What you said about Kevin Durant and also DeMar DeRozan and other people who are just openly admitting, like, yeah, I struggle. And I think it's particularly poignant for me, and not in a way that I was expecting or even realizing that I needed. I don't know if that needed is the right word, because I wasn't so much affected personally, I was just impressed that person came out and talked openly about it, and that he's a man of color. And I'm from a very much a boys don't cry culture, growing up, very much boys don't cry. My dad himself struggled, I think, because he was an emotional person, and he was very okay with being openly emotional, but you could tell there were moments, particularly say in public, if those emotions were negative, like crying or pouting, where that boys don't cry masculinity would come out. So there's, like, there was mixed messages, I guess you could say, in my community. But at the end of the day, amongst my generation, so like my cousins and my sibling and my immediate friends, because I grew up in the body of where that stuff was just seen as a form of weakness, as an easy avenue for bullying. It really just teaches you to sort of choke it down, but not in the cliche way of like, holding back tears, more like ignoring it, right? Like you don't, it's like having an illness that you just pretend you don't have because it's not giving you symptoms right then.
Yeah.
And it always comes up later, right? All that stuff always comes out. Particularly in my group of cousins, it came out often, like in forms of violence. I don't mean like felonious assault. I just mean like, you know, getting into fights at bars, right? Looking for reasons to take things personally, put out your aggression in the world because you got all this misplaced rage. And as I say it out loud, I guess it was kind of cliche. But that's definitely where I came from. But mostly, it's just like, you know, like you said, one of the reasons I wanted to do this is like, we just didn't talk about it. And not in a silenced way. Not in a way where it was taboo. At least I didn't ever felt that way. We just did. It just never came up. Like, we didn't think to. It was almost less of a cultural imperative to pretend that we didn't have anxiety. Other than maybe anxiety was just a given, why discuss it? It was almost like, yeah, it was just, it almost felt like it never occurred to anyone to have that discussion. when I brought it up with certain people later in life, they almost seemed surprised that someone would talk about this. It wasn't even so much resistance as it was, you know, a lack of experience of how to do it because they never were prompted to do so.
Yeah. I remember the first time I really had a deep conversation about anxieties and like the small little bouts of depression that I have with someone. And it's you don't really know how rewarding and freeing it is to have that conversation until you had it. And I think sort of that hung over the society that I grew up in. Nobody talked about it. So we didn't know like the endorphins we got from talking about it. It's just like, we can't, you know, like I'm making this a problem by thinking about it. So I can't talk about it.
Yeah, it's crazy how much that notion is true, just talking about it. My first time was with my, you know, with Kara, who ended up being my best lady at my wedding. Mm-hmm. And I got to the point where I was having panic attacks, and I sort of, to illustrate what I was talking about, I thought I was having a legitimate heart problem. And I went mm-hmm. to the doctor, and they said, no, you're fine. You just, I don't know, go get some sleep or something. And I realized it was anxiety and panic attacks. Because I'd never dealt with the death of my father, basically. Mm-hmm. And when I realized that, then I started talking about it. It took forever to talk about it. And actually, it was kind of painful for a while because it sort of triggered nightmares for the longest time because I was confronting it for the first time, you know, because in like 4 or 5 years, I just choked it down with alcohol and Klonopin, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, just doing that, but I still struggled with sort of the language of it and how to channel it. For me, a lot of it, for me, negative emotion turns into rage, and probably because I was taught to turn it into rage, I think, to be honest. Not by my father or my mother, but just so much by the culture, right? You know, it's super Latino, man. It's so, like, performatively masculine and a very specific and detailed script that you're just supposed to follow, right? And one of them is the acceptable male emotion is rage, and that's the one I can express well. I don't rage much. I'm not an angry person. But when I have a severe emotion, rage becomes the only way to express it. And when I say rage, I don't mean like fighting or throwing punches. Not anymore, anyway. But more like just anger. Like, just anger that I can't place because I'm old enough to know that, you know, you don't take it out on somebody else, right?
Yeah.
It just sort of goes up into the air.
Yeah, recently, I've been in a down mood for the past couple of weeks. And like, it's nothing specific. It's just like a couple little things adding up. And I've just been in a real down mood and I've noticed it coming out when I'm at work. Like, I've gotten into a couple of altercations with guests I'm speaking with, you know, where I felt bad that I escalated that situation. And I mostly escalated that situation just because I'm not in the best, I don't feel the best about myself currently. And I sort of take that out on other people without knowing it until it's escalated to a point where it's like, oh, I need to step back for a second.
Let me ask you mm-hmm. a question about that, because we've been talking a lot about anxiety. Anxiety is the one that sort of centers around a lot because it's, you know, those feelings of nervousness, of negative heightenedness, right? What you're bringing up, you know, a down period is more akin to depression. Not that I'm asking you to have depression, but I guess we should maybe talk about that because I think that anxiety is easy to write off as stress outside mm-hmm. factors, which makes us easier for us to sort of understand it or come to terms with it or even just talk about it. I guess maybe what we should talk about, because you brought it up, is, and I think this is particularly important for gay men of color who aren't supposed to demonstrate what can be read as weakness, is how do we deal with and express sadness? Because I find that one is much harder for me to deal with than mm-hmm. stress. Like, stress, I got. I can't. Yeah. I feel like I handle anxiety pretty well. I'm one of those people who can turn it into work energy and do something productive with it. Or at least I've learned how to do that. Probably a better way of saying it. But sadness, that one's hard, right? Whether it be the low-key, just blue mood, or whether it be, you know, in response to something tragic, sadness for me is honestly terrifying. I almost didn't get married, not because I didn't love my now wife, but because I was so afraid of divorce.
Yeah.
So afraid of it. Because I'm a child of divorce, and the sadness that generates, I just didn't want to handle it. I can't handle I just can't handle it. So, or I have difficulty with it. So you just talked about, you know, having this low-key, more down mood, as I would call it.
Yeah.
So I guess how do you handle that? Do you confront it? Do you try to understand it? Do you just accept it as part of the ebbs and flow of being a person? Like, what do you do about that?
Yeah, you just got to write it out. For me personally, like, I've had bouts of depression for probably the last 20, 25 years. I didn't really understand what it was until maybe probably 5-10 years ago. But it just, I get in these funks and then it just, I can't kick it for a while. And really for me, it's just riding it out. My medical history is a course at SUNY Buffalo. Charlatan psychiatry and troubleshooting undertow. Nervous in the service still. I'm burger meat and purple pills here. Thank you, but call your name. Sure you will. Skipped lunch. I'm shrunk. I probably need to speak to someone, like a professional. We hinted, or we chatted about this briefly before the pod, but I did therapy for a little while. Immediately after my dad passed, we did group therapy as a family, and it really helped me at that time, but it also took me to places mentally that I don't think I was ready to go. And that's what was kind of scary about therapy to me at that time. And I think it's what's kind of holding me back right now, is because there's probably things I don't like about myself that I need to work on with a professional. And I'm kind of afraid to do that. Yeah.
Now, I'm glad that you brought up therapy, and because I think that's a lot of the conversation about stigmatization and also care comes to therapy. Therapy becoming a very, as something that I see online being discussed a lot, and usually in very, very adamantly positive, aggressively positive tone, and only social media can do, right?
Yeah.
You know? And, I have a lot of questions. So, like you said, like, we talked about this in the Father's Day pod. We both lost our fathers around the same age, around the same time of our lives.
Early 20s. Yeah, like right when you're becoming an adult.
Right, yeah. Right. And the one thing that is very different is that you sought therapy while I leaned on the cultural things I was taught to do. Mm-hmm. It's just, you're allowed to cry at the funeral, which I couldn't do. I could not cry at the funeral. When Austin died 2 years later, who was one of my best friends, I bawled like a baby at that point, but the dam was already broken. But I didn't cry at I just couldn't do it. I just felt like, okay, that's normal. I was definitely sad. Yeah. Definitely demonstrated sadness, but I just, I'm gonna say couldn't cry. I'm gonna say didn't cry.
Yeah.
Like, it occurred to me, like, should I be crying? Everyone's crying. Like, I'm super sad and shocked. I did cry later, like, alone.
Yeah.
But, I did not cry then. When Austin died, I cried.
Yeah.
I did not seek out or attempt therapy. And that's for personal reasons. So my father, as you know, but I'll stay on the pod for as much context as possible from what I'm going to say. My father got divorced and then his cancer returned and he was clearly on death's door and he ended up committing suicide. And that fucked me up for a long time, obviously, as it would anybody. And you learn so many things about a person after they die. That's the thing that still trips me out. I learned so much about my father, my grandmothers, Austin, after they died.
Yeah.
Than when they were alive. Because, I don't know why.
That's how it works.
How it works. Because with distance, you see a larger, the distance of the gulf between life and death, you see a greater expanse, especially because you start meeting people you would not have met otherwise, right? So one of the things I learned about my father is that he was in therapy for a while.
I didn't know
And yeah, he was in therapy for a while. I didn't know that either. Yeah. After he died, he didn't tell us. It's hard not to assume it was because he felt that it questioned his masculinity. This is a man whose body had betrayed him already, whose marriage was falling apart. So I don't think he could take another blow to his ego or reputation. Well, and again, like in the privacy of our home, he encouraged emotional expression, but he obviously hid much of his from us. Mm-hmm. But when I found that out, like it embedded in me, And we'll start in the personal and then we'll go more towards the structural, but it embedded in me a very deep distrust of therapy. And the reason is, and this is 19-year-old grief-stricken me thinking, well, I mean, not only did it not help him, he committed suicide. So, well, I'm not blaming therapy for his suicide. That's 100% his choice. It did fail to intervene. That is how I felt at 19.
Yeah.
Today, I can logically see that there are fallacies all over what I just said, but emotionally, that's still there.
Yeah.
Emotionally, I distrust therapy. And part of the reason is I was able to sort of successfully self, I don't know what the word would be, self-therapize. With the use of friends and just being very open and finally just letting all my ball of emotions out and having, and being very fortunate having very dear friends that would just put up with a lot of late night phone calls for me and tears and rage and without them I'd still be lost, right? So I never needed therapy in the way that someone traumatized should get it. No, that's not true. I definitely needed it. I ended up getting the benefits elsewhere, right? Mm-hmm. But I clearly would have benefited, I think, at 19. But that idea, that association of therapy to my father's death, just in subconscious ways, I've not broken. So, and I have some structural questions and critiques about healthcare that I'm going to get to later in the pod. Yeah. But I don't know. Like, this is one of the interesting things because this is where you and my paths is one of the few moments that diverge so wildly because we have such similar backgrounds, and yet this one aspect is very different.
Yeah.
So I don't know what I just that's a big dump of information I just gave you, but I don't know what are your reactions to that. Like, what would you tell someone like me who just is deeply skeptical of therapy for whatever reason, either deeply personal, part of it is probably some embedded masculine ideas about I don't need help, right?
Yeah. I would say even if you aren't ready for a one-on-one therapist session, I would say I would recommend group therapy, especially if you're going through a trauma, like something like that. Like what I went through going to group therapy was such a huge help for me, because one, I was surrounded by people going through the same thing. And so I was able to talk with people going through the same thing. I mean, honestly, like me and your friendship really blossomed after my father died because you had went through a similar thing and I was able to talk to you and you understood exactly what I was going through.
Bro, I still remember from my favorite party moments with you, where one of us would make my father's dead joke, and only the other one could laugh
yes.
at it. And everyone else at the table had to sit there, quietly, afraid to react, while you and me could just howl or one up each other. And for me too, that was yeah. super therapeutic.
Yeah. It helped, and I mean, I'm still like, we've talked about it on this pod. I'm still not exactly over the death of my father, but it did help me contextual, like, you know, put myself in the right mindset about that my father was gone and that my life wasn't over. And then I had to continue to live and things like that. Like therapy absolutely helped me there. Now there are other things, honestly, I should probably talk to a therapist about. And that's something I would challenge myself. And I honestly, if hell, you're probably in a good spot. Like, I don't know, like, even if you're in a good spot or bad spot, I think therapy is beneficial. I think just verbalize, like, you don't know your problems or bullshit until you say them out loud sometimes, especially to a person who has no context of you or your problems. So sometimes just verbalizing it, you'll get answers just by talking. And that's probably the biggest thing that you get from it.
I mean, the world seems to agree with you because more and more people are going. It's one of the most, it's one of the increasingly popular forms of therapy. I was mostly yeah. medication. That's not what I mean. Therapy. Yeah. Prescription. Medicine, right?
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I see a lot is therapy is medicine. We should be thought of as medicine, right?
Yeah.
Which is an analogy I like, but I do think it opens up, and again, I'm speaking from a position of embedded skepticism. But it opens up avenues of, I won't say critique because I don't know, but I yeah. will say interrogation, right?
Mm-hmm.
That I don't know if how much I'm going to bring some of my sort of structural questions up. I don't know how much of this is fair, how much of it is motivated by my own personal stigmas, but I'm going to move forward anyway in the spirit of having the conversation. And I welcome correction.
Yeah.
Obviously, either from you or online. I think you would agree that as bold and often spoken through bravado, my opinions tend to be. I always do take feedback, well, I think. So, at least I welcome it. I may not accept it, but I will give it the stage. I will engage with it. I think. I mean, you can love it. Or, you know, the pop. So, because of the idea that it's medicine, it makes me think about the healthcare industry and all the structural inequalities that are in there. So I was looking up some stats. I did a lot of just looking into this. Here's sort of this little structural issue. So the average cost of a single 1 hour therapy session, the average cost is about $100. $75 on the low end, $150 on the high end, but as much as $300 in places like New York City and LA, right?
Yeah.
And insurance doesn't cover it as much as it should, right? Despite the fact that in 2008 we passed the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act, which is supposed to make mental health and substance abuse treatment as easy to get as anything else, but I think only 9 states have really, really committed to doing it. Most are, the language is so vague that most people can just say, like, no, it is, right? Or it falls in the umbrella, like, yeah, therapy's hard to get, so is all medicine.
Yeah.
This is Idaho, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. How do we address this? The sort of structural inequalities of how difficult it is to get. So even if you have the means, there isn't always space for you to get the medicine you deserve. It's generally difficult to get medicine and healthcare in this country. And if therapy is medicine, how do we factor that into this conversation?
Well, because our healthcare system is so flawed. Well, actually, okay. So we think about mental health better than we did previously, but as a whole, we don't think about it as medicine. We don't think of it as a necessity. We don't think about it the way we think of birth control for women or different things like that. Maybe it's changing that conversation, but right now, our biggest hurdle is that we don't even think healthcare is a necessity or a right for everyone. So getting a therapist is going to be low, low, low on the list, you know, for everyone.
Right. And that feeds into the insurance being scared, how it covers it. I think that, though, that treating it as medicine, I think, would solve one of the sort of back-end problems. One of my frustrations with the healthcare conversation is that we fetishize the role of the insurance agency. The insurance agency is just a middleman, and we're all arguing over how big a cut he's going to get.
Yeah.
One of the questions that I always ask, and it gets lost in conversations about healthcare a lot because we fetishize coverage over access or cost, and that is, why is this so expensive in the first place, right? Why is this, what is driving up the cost? And one of the things I discovered, which frankly made me sad, is I went to multiple, and this is a real small, you know, sampling. I went to many different therapist websites since I could, and I went to a bunch of blogs about the problems with insurance. And the fact of the matter is that much like with Medicaid, the group nature of a certain insurance plans bring down the price, right? Yeah. Medicaid, for example, can, because it has such a large customer base, can negotiate prices. So if you have regular insurance, you're paying more for the same medicine than the person on Medicaid, because Medicaid has a big enough clientele that they can barter.
Right? Yeah.
They can argue down prices. There's some level of that with the insurance suppliers because they have to provide certain services, right? So what they do is they undercut the price. And what a lot of therapists do is they just prioritize non-insured customers because they can charge them more.
Yeah.
So there's this weird, like, having insurance doesn't even get you the medicine. Weirdly, not having insurance will get you front of the line. If you don't have insurance, it's very unlikely you can afford $200 a session.
Yeah, you're not going to – the people who can't afford aren't going to get the help they need.
Right.
No.
Right. And you see that trickle down, right? It trickles down to the street level where we have – people with clear mental health issues being dealt with by the police.
Yeah.
And while I won't exculpate the police for any violence enacted on those individuals, at the same time, those are not the people that are supposed to be dealing with the mentally ill. Like, that is, at least we can all agree, not their job. Now, when they go one step forward and make it their job, they can, then they, you know, crack someone's skull open with their nightstick. Okay, you're not going to get off the hook for that. But they should not have fallen to that level.
No, it's people who are that, like, that type of mental illness. Like, we decided a while ago that we just didn't give a shit about them. As, like, American society just decided it's, we can save some money by tossing them aside. And that's even bigger conversation. Like, we're talking about mental, our mental health. We're not, like, homeless. Our lives aren't in danger by a police officer call, or well, hopefully. But, like, that's just a, that's a different level of it.
So you want to hear something else that's even worse? Yeah. We're talking about people we don't care about?
Oh.
The Journal on Health and Social Behavior. Mm-hmm. Journal of Health and Social Behavior, yes. Okay. And this was quoted in The Atlantic. I didn't read the journal. This is quoted in The Atlantic.
Okay.
Just to make that clear. I have not read this myself. But it is still to this day all class and insurance and economic factors being equal. White patients are much more likely to get appointments than people of color, mm-hmm. when that's the only distinguishing feature. They just don't get accepted.
Yeah.
Because the therapists are allowed to choose their clientele, and people of color, shockingly enough, are
always left out.
Always are often left out.
Often left out.
Often left out. It's not always. It's not quite that bad.
But I mean, I live in Houston, man. Like, we have a homelessness problem that is getting out of hand, but it's hard for me to, like, we can't talk about the homelessness problem without talking about mental health of these people that we've completely given up on. Mm-hmm. And we're currently in an administration that's completely taken, that's only taken away more rights. Pre-existing conditions, that's gone. Like, Medicare outreach, it's gone. It's gone. It just feels like we're constantly losing each battle. I don't know. It's been a rough week.
You're sitting in a waiting room, you're dreaming of Arcadia, you're feeling like a baby fool, the waiting panacea, channeling your inner Beowulf in purgatory just before you pay up to fillet yourself. And others in the name of help, cold on a conveyor belt, in an ego death alone, no telephone from Gabriel. I'm half a human, combing over home and garden stone, gold chains over turtleneck, cigars over cologne, 1,000 shitty paintings wrap around a wounded animal, womb with a Schubert, he's a future human cannonball, little fuckers fighting, mother hiding in her Hulu. I'm climbing up the stucco. Let's get to the seppuku. Uh-oh. That pretty penny turned a prickly into Benji. If you save up all your winnings, then you get to count your blessings. I finally crunched the budget up and punched the button. She called my name out and pushed me into an oven. The fuck? I'm shrunk.
I think what's going on with my country also plays a large part to my mental health. Because even when I'm not thinking about my bullshit, when I take a look up, it's the country's bullshit. And it's only affected me negatively, I think, mentally, very recently. Like, since the whole kid thing happened, like, I've just been in the, just done.
Yeah, yeah, that whole, like, news fatigue shit is real, man.
Yeah, it's...
You gotta
plug
sometimes.
Well, and I, going back, like, I think screens have been a big deterrent on my mental health. I think I sit at a computer all day. When I'm not at a computer, I'm staring at my phone. I'm looking at Twitter. I think all of that has really been a negative.
Oh, yeah, and read a book.
I know. Like, I think that's going to be one of the little tricks I use to try to make myself feel better. It's just like, yeah, just get a book and start reading. Stay away from a TV screen. Try to get out and do more things. Like, I'm going to Mexico next month. I'm hoping that's a real chance to unwind.
I'm glad you brought that up. We're going to close the talk about self-care, but I have a couple more questions about therapy. I guess talk therapy is basically what you did.
Right? Yes. Yeah.
So I saw some things. One thing I was looking up to, a conversation I wandered into, is if therapy is medicine,
mm-hmm.
and I agree that it is. It's the way physical therapy is medicine, right?
Yeah.
Bring physical therapy up as an analogy. Because one curious thing about me is I'll run the physical therapy. As you know, I've got all these little sports and mayhem and Jameson related injuries.
You and me both, man.
Yeah, I know you do too. I need constant management. And, you know, I'm getting real, real close to 40, right?
Yeah.
Small 40 from here. So I have no issues with physical therapy. Like, yeah, get in here, crack my bones, because I'm an old, broke-down man.
Yeah.
My masculinity is right out the window when my back hurts or my knees are sore. Like, I'm all about getting help.
Yeah.
I have no compunction. Like, I'm taking the, I ran 3 miles a day. I can't take the stairs just today. Today I'm taking the elevator up 2 floors. It should move. But my legs are tired.
Yeah.
Gotta take care of my bodies. But I don't do that mentally enough.
Mm-hmm.
But if therapy is medicine, and I believe that it is medicine, this is a conversation I ran into as I was just bouncing around the internet, is then the possibility of over-prescription exists. Does it not?
I would have to say so. I would just, the law of averages, like, of course, like, that has to be an issue.
Right. I don't know how much of an issue, I don't know how fair this is, and again, as a disclaimer, part of this is motivated by general skepticism. I have known people who openly take therapy,
yeah,
and if I could make a very broad and probably problematic generalization, is the ones that seem to have the best relationship to it in the sense that they both came to a close with it, but also accomplished something. So I exclude two possibilities. People mm-hmm. who tried it but didn't really try it, didn't know what they were doing and gave up really quickly. Or people who have been doing it forever and ever and just do it like constantly. This is going to be something they do probably forever. I wonder about, but in physical therapy, the first thing they teach you is like, you're going to do this on your own. Like, you're not supposed to be here. And the nuances between why someone chooses therapy are broad, of course, right? There's something like you and me where we experience the trauma and we need help over a very specific hurdle. There's this sort of more low-key therapy where someone's overwhelmed by sudden changes in their life. It might not be based on trauma. It's just based on sudden structural upheaval, right? Suddenly moving, new job, isolation, etc., right? Just life. Fucking just life. So this life is fucking enough reason to go get help, right? And then of course people who have something that just needs to be managed, like someone who's bipolar, for example, that's not the same as someone who broke their ankle, is not the same as someone who...
Yeah. It's closer to, it's like arthritis, like...
Yeah. Like arthritis versus a twisted ankle. That's a great analogy.
Yeah.
I do worry about overprescription though, because it just feels like an area that where abuse could easily happen, and I don't mean in the like nefarious predatory way, although I'm sure that's possible.
Yeah.
I just mean in as a result of the conversation, because we do tend to overprescribe medicine in every other respect, right?
Yeah.
Now those are pills, not something that takes the labor of thought therapy, so there's an important distinction there. But if you don't mind me asking you, so what was the conversation like when you went to therapy? Were the goals clear? What was it, like a limited number of sessions? You got 8 times and that's it. Like, sometimes insurance companies will do that. You get 4 sessions. You better fix it in 4 sessions.
So it was structured. It was structured around the 5 stages of grief. So each week we would tackle a part of the 5 stages of grief. And then at the end of that, we learned that that was bullshit, that we would have to be dealing with each of these emotions constantly every day of our lives and not necessarily in that order. But it was structured through the 5 stages of grief.
Right. So it sounds like it had, like you guys discussed and had some pretty clear, like the language I saw online is treatment goals.
Yes, we had treatment goals. It was to get to acceptance.
Okay.
And then learn what that meant to live with acceptance. And it was very structured around that.
I think to the average listener, that could feel abstract. What was that like in practice? Do you remember much? Do you mind sharing?
This was like 16 years ago, but from what I remember, like, we got assignments. So sometimes it was your turn to read your assignment, and your assignment was to talk about like your feelings and the ideas. And I remember being there for a young girl who spoke, and it she said pretty much what I was feeling. And I remember I had a break, my own mental breakthrough, like, not a big breakthrough, but like I felt better hearing her words, and that comforted me. But in the class itself, it was mostly my anxiety came out. I was like, fuck, I don't want to talk. Fuck, I don't want to talk. But hearing people talk made me more comfortable about the things that I was going through.
I mean, that makes sense. It makes so much sense. You see where that film cliche comes from.
Yeah.
But you know, sometimes cliches often have a negative truth, right? At least if,
but the big breakthrough isn't a real thing. Like it's more just you realize things and then they can help you cope with that, and then it really opens up a different thing you have to cope with. But that's how it was for me. It's not going to be the same for everyone.
Of course.
But I think you brought up something I did want to talk, like abuse. The abuses that we have that are open that are clearly predatory, like life coaches and shit like that.
Oh, good point.
Or mediums or like people who exploit other people's anxiety or fear or their ill feelings about themselves. Like, I think that is where the abuse is. Or people who therapy's not enough. Well, I'm talking to a life coach now and I'm doing this and that. Like, I think those kind of people are deceitful.
Do you think the pushback, just for the sake of pushing back, honestly, that's a really good point. I hadn't thought about this. Just being a little contrarian, admittedly. Do you think, because I agree with you, I think, at least in a sort of suspicious way, like the idea of a life coach, the idea of a medium. I've never engaged with any of these people in real life. Some of it is what I pick up from culture. Some of it is just my own red alarms, right? Mm-hmm. I have a tendency, I think, like most people do, to trust my judgment of character. And so that does feel predatory. Right?
Yeah.
I feel you on that. If the person benefits, does it matter?
I don't know.
Like, where's the line between
between
a parasitic relationship and a what's the other one? Mutually beneficial. Come on, what's the science name? What's the science word I'm looking for?
Symbiotic.
There it is. Yeah. The symbiotic relationship, right, is in the symbiotic relationship, the two people aren't looking to help each other. They're acting selfishly. Yeah. Their selfishness just happens to benefit the other one, so they keep committing it. Whereas parasitic relationship is one-sided, right?
Yeah.
There's no benefit, right, to the host or to the partner. So I like you said, law of averages, swinging the other way, I want to believe that those can be productive, but man, I'm with you on how sketchy it seems.
It makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah.
When someone's, I don't know, like I'm a skeptic. Like, I'll admit, like, I'm a skeptic. I'm pretty dismissive of a lot of things. So when somebody's talking to me about like, yeah, they touched me and they balance my chakra and shit like that, I'm just like, get the fuck out of my face. like just that, I'm just like, I'm so dismissive of that.
Yeah, I was gonna talk about my yoga class today, and now I'm afraid to.
She says, I'm not your enemy. I said, that sounds like something that my enemy would say. Instead of playing off the chemistry, she said, you're being difficult. I said, I'm being guarded. You're a quarter million dead. I get more guidance from my barber. Look, I'm not good at this. I grew up in a noogie fest. You built your walls up higher. Said goodbye to all your cookie puss. Here's one. Every time my telephone buzzes, I see images.
We're
going
to talk about mental health. Meditation has been proven to be the most beneficial thing that a person can do. Like everything, meditation, like I've looked at YouTube videos, people who quit drugs, people who like had substance abuse problems with self-medicating things, like they all preached to the choir about meditation. Meditation is like the best thing. And yoga involves a lot of meditation. Like I get why people love yoga. And I'm not saying like, and maybe yoga is the thing that's like, oh, it's beneficial to people. You know, they ignore that it's religious history and all this kind of thing. I don't know. It's just, I'm uneasy with it. It seems dirty to me.
Well, they call it hot yoga for a reason, I guess.
Well.
Oh, that's not what you meant. My bad.
No,
I hear you. I feel that way a lot about, like talk therapy, I think. But tacitly, subconsciously, I just sort of consumed that into my being. It wasn't until this conversation started that I really, really thought about my distaste for the idea of it. And I do try to at least interrogate myself for it. Like, why do I feel this way? how much of it is genuinely healthy skepticism and how much is me looking to, you know, project my reality into the world to achieve some form of confirmation bias, right?
No.
But since you brought up, you know, yoga and you brought up all these things, mm-hmm. the one part of the conversation which I really like and I talk to my students about a lot is self-care.
Yeah.
So with my students in particular, I really talk to them about self-care. So one of the things, for example, that I do is I make a lot of my important assignments due at midnight. And I tell them, why is it due at midnight? And I said, because I want you to go to sleep. This is not that important. Right? Yeah. This is important for this class and it's important to you because you want to do well. But this is not a life or death essay, right? No one other than me is going to care what you think about Slaughterhouse-Five. It'll probably never come up, right? But if you care about the skills you learn, et cetera, blah, 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 there's value to the class. I don't try to say my class doesn't matter. I just try to keep it in perspective. I go to a school that's one of those, like, high anxiety attrition rates, right? Like, the kids who want to do good, the Kelly Kapowskis come to where I go.
Or the Jesse Spanos.
And actually, that's even better. The Jesse Spanos. There are a lot of people that are just so excited on my campus. And I gotta talk.
I see what you did there.
Yeah, you like that?
Yeah.
And I gotta talk them down. So one of the things I tell them is like, get your sleep, take care of yourself. I said, I don't want you up till 5 in the morning writing your essay. Now, if you are, and I see you have a timestamp that says 4 a.m., I'm not gonna call it late. Yeah. Like, I get that you were up late working, you probably had other things to work on, right? I am going to feel bad for you, right? Like, and then what I tell them a lot is, like, if you're running up against the clock, asking for extension, as long as you ask for it with a couple days of notice, I'll give it to you every time because I don't want you stressing out, right? And, you know, and I think a lot of them, they're really susceptible to it. And I think especially now, they're expecting to hear conversations about self-care in a way that never hasn't before. So I guess to close, like, what do you do? Like, what are your thoughts on self-care? What do you do? What are you managing?
Really? Like, I think I don't do enough to make sure I self-medicate with alcohol and I play a lot of video games, but I think video games are the one thing that I do to kind of turn my mind off. So I'm not in my own head a lot.
Video games can be very meditative.
I've been playing Dark Souls the most. I think Dark Souls has been sort of the thing. It scratches for me is what I need when I'm not working or out socializing and things like that. Like, video games are really the thing that helped me get through. I also like to go to concerts. Like, concerts are another thing that helped me because I can kind of turn my brain off at concerts. Because music is a big, big part of my life. Music really helps me. I like to zone out. Like, it kind of turns off my brain. And that's really what I need when I'm trying to feel better, is I need my brain to turn off.
No. I think that's why people really love meditation, too.
Yeah.
Because it gets you out of your own kind of self-consciousness. You sort of just, whether it's like the sort of yoga, body mindfulness meditation, or it's a guided sort of fantasy meditation. When you develop on your own, I do a lot of these. I've done a lot of these, and I do agree that it helps. I don't know that there is a sort of, I don't want to say cultish because that's so condescending, but there's this sort of intense devotion to it.
Yeah.
For people who are practitioners that I don't share, but I do enjoy. Like, it's part of it's in my cycle. Although I want to go back and say something, that if I used Dark Souls to unwind, I would be in therapy. That game is fucking crazy. And I don't mean in the sense that video games make people crazy. I'm not Jeff Sessions in this.
Yeah.
I mean that game is so brutally difficult that I don't understand how that could ever calm somebody down. But to each his own. I know you love that genre of games.
Well, it's those games are ultimately about letting go and being okay with failing. And execution. Like, if you lose in a Dark Souls, if you ever lose a Dark Souls, because you didn't execute properly. So you're okay when you die, because, like, it's okay to fuck up sometimes.
That is a wonderfully poetic message to get from Dark Souls.
Yeah!
Dark Souls Remastered! It's okay to fuck up sometimes.
Yeah! You're gonna die.
Dark Souls. You be you!
Better. Each time you're gonna fail, you're gonna fail constantly, and you're better every time, because you failed.
Dark Souls. Follow your bliss into the maw of hell.
Play Dark Souls, man. It's great. They're fucking fun.
Man.
Great.
I've told you before. I am. I'm. What's his name on The Simpsons? The older Corleone. Fat Tony? No, not Fat Tony. The older Corleone, Sonny.
Oh, Sonny, okay.
Who played Sonny?
James Caan.
James Caan of The Simpsons was going out by Eric Bobble and he said, "Some men like a challenge, not me." That's my opinion of video games. I played Journey, I zone out. I just play Journey, I put out some explosives in the sky, and I just play Journey on loop.
I love those kind of games too. I like Journey a lot.
No, I know you do. Yeah. You need to play Brothers. I'm calling you out online.
I do. Yeah, you're right. I do need to play Brothers.
I can't be the only one.
I've beaten Dark Souls this one once. Once I beat it the second time, then I think I'll be done. And that's my next one.
Self-care.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of stigmas, you said you self-medicate. Alcohol, I mean, I ain't got to tell you, that's a slippery slope.
Yeah. Oh, I know.
Yeah. But I was there because I did that. I was a functioning alcoholic, I think, for years.
Yeah.
Like, I was, that was in my sort of darkest moments when I was medicating really hard drugs, you know, Quantipan, Darvocet, anything people could give me. And this is, again, I've never been to therapy. These are all without prescription. Yeah. Because I was in such just turmoil that I was just like, I was short circuiting my brain. I was turning myself off, right?
Yeah.
Xanax, whatever, anything I get my hands on. And then eventually I just hit a crisis point and I had the moment of clarity. Ironically, my moment of clarity is realizing one of my friends was a drug addict. And I was like, wait a minute. Oh. I see you every night, you know?
Yeah. That's how I learned I was a hipster.
That's almost as bad. That's almost as bad. Welcome to the club, though. I've been a hipster forever. I don't even care. I'm not. I'm the hipster, man. At this point, like, I want to know where all the hipsters are hanging out, and then I want to know when they're not there.
I just want to get there 2 hours before all the hipsters.
Right. I'll go the day before. I'll give them a wide berth, which is the most hipster thing you can fuck.
Yeah.
I'm 100% still there. But one thing I did stick to, going back to our conversation.
Yeah.
Is marijuana.
Yeah.
I use marijuana, I realize more and more to self-medicate. I live in a state where it's legal, so I can do that. The stigma here is dissipated, at least in terms of legality and criminality.
Right? Yeah.
I think that we need to have a serious discussion about the role of marijuana as legitimate self-care. I really stand by it. Now, can it be abused? Sure, but so can all forms of medication, right? Everyone needs to have a rational and responsible relationship to whatever you're using to decompress, right?
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite thing to do now is to combine the two is I'll have an edible and I'll go get a 90-minute sports massage.
Okay.
Oh, man, I'm never happier than ever in my life. Like, anything. You can tell me any bad news in the middle of the session and I'd just be, oh, man, that's just the way the world goes, right? So I think that things that combine physical therapy and mental health to me really work. So today, for example, I did yoga, but it's a mindfulness yoga. So it involves stretching, but also lots of meditative elements blended into it. It's for beginners, so it's not really breaking new ground for me, but it really is just, it just works. Like, it just, the stretching is good for my body and the meditative is good to calm my mind because of the anxiety that my physical limitations incur. Right, but I think that finding what works is just what matters. Uh-huh. You know, it's as apprehensive as I have expressed today. You really don't know if it'll work until you try it, right? So, I need to allow therapy to be a legitimate option when I need it. As you said, like, I just got married. I'm in a pretty good place right now, so not the place where I need anything.
But, hey, you're always in a good place until you're not. And sometimes you don't know you're not in a good place until, like, it's already, like, you're in the middle of it, you know? So you never know. Like, I would say there's never a bad time to try therapy.
And I think more than that, I think I agree 100%.
Yeah.
Right? I agree, even though quietly, I'm inside, I'm like, I agree for you. Like, my on the inside, I'm like, it needs to be okay not to take it. it's going to be okay to take it too. Yeah. But I don't want to voice that too loudly because I don't want to make the stigma worse, because I do believe that therapy should be a legitimate form of medicine and anybody who feels that they need it should have access to it. I would never enforce my prejudice on another. One thing I saw over and over, and I was blogging about self-care and about whether you should consider therapy, most of them, if not all of them, you know, I went to suicide prevention sites, I tried to get as broad a sample as I could, given that these are internet articles, so you read all of them in 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah.
This is admittedly shallow, or maybe I should say surface, right? But the one thing I see a lot, and this is, I think, maybe something we could think about closing on, is just having a support network of family and friends and taking advantage of it, right?
Yeah.
And we opened with talking about how we need to break the stigma and actually have these conversations. But I think the most important thing I've seen online is that we need to have these conversations privately, one-on-one, and just hear each other out and also seek each other out. So you hinted at this earlier, and it's almost like a form of preventative medicine. It's a little bit the tone I'm seeing. So the question I'll ask you is, how often, if ever, do you reach out? What are the circumstances in which you do reach out? Are you a denier? Are you a trying to solve it yourself first kind of person? But who do you reach out to? Do you reach out? Like, what is your relationship to actually voicing your emotions in the spirit of just proper mental health maintenance?
I'll let a lot of shit go ultimately, because at the end of the day, certain things just don't matter. Like, it's not worth the mental exercise to handle certain things. So I let a lot of shit go. But if I'm like really in a bad place, I have a lot of friends I'm really close with. I typically reach out to the friend I know who's dealt with something similar to that, who I'm very close with. So like, I rely on my friends when I'm in that down place. And I think I have a friend, like each of my friends I have like a close enough relationship with, like I could text you, or I could text Javi, or I could text Joel, or I could text certain people and be like, hey, I'm in a bad spot. Like, can we hang, or different things? Like, when can we get together? Because when we get together, we're going to talk about it. It'll take my mind off it. It's either one or the other. But I have enough. I think I have a good roster of friends, I guess is the way to put it. But I have people in my life who I can rely on when I'm in situations where I'm not feeling the best. It's really the network of friends I've built that really helped me cope with my mental health issues.
But let me ask you a question, though, because I feel exactly the same way, right? Yeah. And I'm willing to bet a lot of people feel that way, too.
Yeah.
But do you wait for a crisis point to reach out, or do you do it regularly?
I don't get to see my friends a lot currently. It's like most people live in different parts of the town, different cities, or they have kids, and it's harder to hang out. So I haven't been getting it as much as I need lately, because usually it would come up organically just hanging out, or they would be the first one to interact when it would make me realize something I'm going through, that I hadn't been willing to talk about. So it's been a lot less recently, I would say.
A lot less that you reach out?
That I reach out, and that I'm getting that mental help. But yeah, it's been a lot less reaching out recently because people are less available.
Well, yeah, there's the ebb and flow of his life, right? Yeah, I think for me, I'm guilty of definitely like doing it at a crisis point. And so still, my default mode is like, I'll figure this out myself. Like, I don't want to be a burden to anybody. And that notion of I don't want to be a burden to anybody goes all the way back to, I don't know if that was a top to be ashamed of my emotions, because it wasn't quite that. But certainly not to express them, because expressing them bums people out, right? Especially if you're a dude. So yeah. I don't want to do it. So it's definitely that masculinity thing for me. I've tried to become better at it. I was the classic, you know, I got too drunk and the truth is coming out. So the problem with that is you have no control over what you're about to fucking say. So I had to cut that shit out. So I had to figure out how to get ahead of that. I try to do check-ins regularly. Like, I have a couple of friends where I'm like, let's talk about how we're doing this check-in emotionally. It feels perfunctory often and very kind of awkward. But you'd be surprised how often somebody just needed the floor. Because a lot of people don't want to be the first one to be like, hey, let's talk about our emotional baggage. Either for the fact that they'll come off as weak, or they'll come off as not really interested in your shit. They want to talk about their shit, etc. So what I think helps me a lot is to hear other people out. And I know this is sort of this weird mental calculation that isn't probably helping in the long run, but I do feel like if I heard you out, then I banked credibility for the future when I need it. So I don't feel bad when I ask you. Which is not an exchange like that. I shouldn't have to feel that somebody owes me one to authorize my emotional expression, but at least it gets me into a routine of checking in mentally. So it's like the other thing, right? Like, it's probably not the most positive way of doing it, but if it gets you to where you need to be, you know, who's going to hold it against you, right?
Yeah. There's no hard answers for all of this. Like, we understand our brains and ourselves, so, like, we're not very much, you know? So, whatever you're doing, if it's working, keep doing it.
But, yeah, but also assess that it's working, right? You're not just kicking in the can, right?
Yeah.
That's where professional can be really useful. Especially, like, if your life isn't going well and you're insisting you're doing the mental work you need to be doing, consider the possibility that you're just not doing it, right? Even, like, it can't be mindless effort, I assume. Right? There must be, you have to be self-aware and self-reflective about it. So what are you going to do next to alleviate some of your anxieties? What's your next self-care step? What are you doing this weekend? What are you going to do? What are going to be our self-care steps or self-improvement steps this weekend?
Good idea. I don't know. I'm definitely gonna play Dark Souls. Yeah, I can definitely see that. I'm probably taking a little break from drinking. Like, I was at a conference last week, so it was a lot of drinking. So I'm gonna take a little breather, maybe clear out that way.
I am going to try to reset my sleep schedule because I've been on summer vacation and I've been really indulgent. Like. Not getting trashed or anything, not waking up over, but I've definitely been a lot of nights, like, staying up till 3 a.m. watching My Hero Academia, getting up at 11, and then, like, I don't gotta do anything today. I don't have any pressing deadlines, so I've authorized myself to just sort of be a kind of a layabout. I mean, I keep, you know, I'm working out and stuff, but I haven't been mentally productive at all, so I'll probably give myself a project to give my life some structure, which I think being on a regular sleep schedule will just be good for me mentally. In general sense, right? It's like you said, you're good until you're not, right? I say that, but I'm already in my head like, well, we're starting Monday, right? not gonna get up at 8:30 on a Saturday. And then I'm like, brain, it's Tuesday.
Yeah, I struggle getting up. Like, I can't. Like, sleep is probably the thing I need to address the most for my mental health.
Yeah, that one just on its own is crazy how important.
Yeah. Sleep is so important. Like, it's... I need to get more sleep because I find myself, like, last Friday I had to work at 6 in the morning, so I knew I wasn't going to be able to fall asleep early, so I still went to sleep at, like, midnight, like 12:30, so I got, like, 4 hours of sleep, and it ruined my whole weekend. It's just, I gotta get more sleep.
All right, all right, man. I will not play Dark Souls.
Oh. Play Bloodborne.
I forgot. I've been so caught up with wedding stuff, I haven't played anything. But maybe I'll play Bloodborne. Maybe I'll play Bloodborne. And I'm going to finish all these comic books that I've started that I haven't finished yet. Yeah, I got a big stack. You know how I get. I just buy, and I'm like, one day I'll read.
Yeah. That's why I quit buying comic books.
I buy just books in general, man. Just books in general. Yeah. I'm a hoarder. Read a book. That'll help you sleep.
Yeah. You got a recommendation?
What do you want? Do I ever.
Yeah, give me something, like, funny. I want something funny.
Something funny. Comic book or novel?
Comic. Give me a comic. I haven't read a comic in a long time.
Matt Fraction's Hawkeye.
Okay.
Matt Fraction's Hawkeye. It's funny, it's weird, it's this indie comic, it's also visually, like, the most kind of, like, interesting thing I've seen in a long, long time. Okay. What else is funny that I've read recently? Moomin and the Brigands, which is just this weird French comic, but I warn you, that might be one of those things that only I find funny.
Okay.
But read Matt Fraction's Hawkeye, it's great.
Matt Fraction's Hawkeye. Done. Okay.
Alright. Cool. Alright, homie. Get some sleep.
Alright, talk to you later. Peace.
said, when you start getting all expressive and symbolic, it's impossible to actualize an honest diagnostic. I said, when you start getting all exact and algebraic, I'm reminded it's a racket, not a rehabilitation. Okay. Agree to disagree as grown ups from opposing clans, honoring the push and pull, I should have called the scholomance. Oh well. Preservation is a doozy. Will you be needing another appointment? Absolutely, I'm shrunk.